I got good news.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
Yes, you do have to do all those things and blow your nose. This is The Week in Review. I'm Steve Scher. Joni Balter is news analyst for KUOW, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger.
Morning.
And Peter Jackson, editorial page editor at The Everett Herald. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good morning.
You're filling the big shoes of Canute.
Very much so.
So I want everything to be wrapped in historical references.
It's the Nordic challenge.
It's the Viking challenge.
It's the Viking challenge. this was an interesting week to start with because we had that people were calling the historic moment over the minimum wage and the debate that's taking place in Seattle at Town Hall Wednesday night. A lot of people showed up. It was a very spirited discussion. The people who were city council, mayor's income inequality advisory committee were listening to people, and it ran the gamut. I want to play one little bit of tape for you as we go into this. And this is Tamara Murphy. She's a restaurant owner. She was listening to all the talk about it, and there were angry voices on both sides. She was saying, you know, there's got to be a way to come to some sort of fair notion of what's happening here. But I'm thinking that might be an impossible proposition. This is what she said.
We are really all in this together. I mean, I get it. I really do. I started working at the age of 15. I was on my own. And I have worked for every dime that I have. And for the past 17 years, I've owned a small business. Terra Plata will not go out of business. I'm happy to say it's very healthy currently. But we will have to reduce our hours. There is no question. We will have to reduce our labor. And these people are family to me. We take care of them the very best we can. It may not be totally up here. It is far above usually minimum wage. So that's the reality of some of the small businesses. And we are here. We don't want to lay off our people. We want to take care of them.
So how are supporters of minimum wage going to answer the concerns of small businesses?
Well, I'll tell you something. Seattle City Councilmember Sally Clark used a very appropriate phrase for what's going on here, that we are entering this time where we're going to have a long, slow boiling point on this discussion, because before it was sort of campaign talk. It was slogans. It was everyone saying, we'll have this committee. Committees are such a great safe haven at the beginning because they're going to go out and gather all this information. And when they come back, they'll say something, you know, anchored in all these interviews and research and all of that good stuff. But we're going to hit some rough spots here because I did host Civic Cocktail last evening, and we had Tom Douglas in there. And this is a guy, if you remember, who said that he very much wanted to raise the minimum wage of his cooks, just his cooks. It's been misconstrued a couple times, to $15 an hour, and dishwashers to $12 an hour. He doesn't sort of worry about waitresses and wait staff because they make a lot in tips. So he did this, and he told the audience last night, it's kind of surprising that he miscalculated. He had written down some numbers of how much it would cost, and it cost a whole bunch more. And so now he's phasing it in.
Did he say how much in your talk?
Yes, sort of like I think he had written down $1.2 million, and then it was getting closer to $2 million. But if it went up even higher, there was another number, and it was higher than that. And so, you know, he wants to do this. He had earlier said his position was that he couldn't have done this early in the sort of creation of his many restaurants. He has about a dozen restaurants. He had to kind of become more successful first and then do this this salary raising that he did last August. And so, you know, this is going to hit a lot of bumps. This week, as you know, folks at Elliott Bay Bookstore said that they might have to go out of business, that the minimum wage, especially if it ratchets up really fast at the very beginning. And so now you have other people, surprisingly, some folks at The Stranger have been talking about phasing it in, which if you think about history, minimum wage, that's how the state of Washington got to $9.32. They had two-year significant raises of 80 cents each year, and then they tied it to inflation. And state of California, which is going to 10 bucks in 2016, two steps. So the phase-in is, you're going to hear a lot about that, is what I think.
And they're just going to 10.
And they're just going to 10. Although San Francisco, just to be fair here, is $10.74 an hour.
Yeah.
Just
Before you answer that second question about how are all the people supporting it going to answer the concerns of small businesses, what was the thinking at the Stranger? What was that article about? What was going on?
Which article?
That sort of raised the question of maybe we should phase this in and not jump too fast.
I think that was Dominic Holden's post about Kshama Sawant and his attempt to get her to tell him whether she was for phasing in or not. And, you know, I would say The Stranger, like a lot of places, has divergent opinion among its staff. And I think that's reflected on Slog, and that's what makes Slog interesting.
Yeah, it's a tough question, though, that everybody's grappling with.
It is a tough question, and I think you're seeing people at The Stranger grappling with it just like everyone else. I think if you read that post by Dominic, which is really thought-provoking, you will see a lot of comments that suggested, well, hang on. Kshama Sawant is negotiating here. $15 now is her negotiating position, and you're asking her to negotiate against herself by proposing an alternative that takes into account what small business owners want. And small business owners have, I think, in these committees been talking about what they want, and there's obviously a gap between $15 an hour now and what small business owners would like to see. What everyone agrees on, which is actually pretty amazing, is that $15 is a good idea. You don't see very many people talking about anything other than $15 an hour. It's $15 now or $15 eventually. Well, how do you think this drama is going to end? It's going to end somewhere in the middle.
You think so?
Yeah. Or somewhere on the side of eventually.
Phase in.
Yeah. But you know, I'm not sure that we can realistically expect, or at least I don't expect, Kshama Sawant to suddenly abandon the $15 now position that she campaigned on. I don't think, or I personally don't believe, that she thinks she's going to get that.
Really?
I think that this is her negotiating position. And so in the end, she will end up somewhere else. I think I would bet that she believes that. And that if the small business owners are right, that will be a good thing for everyone. Hmm. We'll get to $15 an hour. Small businesses will be able to make the transition, and we'll have the highest minimum wage in the nation still, but by, you know, an order of magnitude when compared to many other states.
Write us at weekinreview@kuow.org, weekinreview@kuow.org, or call us during the show, which is right now, 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289. 5869 206-543-5869. We want your thoughts on this. Just Peter, you were looking at what the conversation was like up in Snohomish County and around Everett, yeah?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. There isn't really necessarily a groundswell among some of these city councils, in part because, you know, they're all small business owners. But you'll find that people like Rick Larson, and now I understand Susan Del Bene, have signed on to the federal minimum wage proposal, which would go up to 10-10, also kind of graduated. And then a big group of Snohomish County legislators, Mike Sells, Luis Moscoso, and others have been pushing this state bill, which probably doesn't, I don't think, gain much traction. But it too would be graduated. It would be $10 in 2015, then $11, and then up to $12. But the $15 apex, I think, might be pushing it a little bit too far.
The state bill has zero traction in Olympia.
Did it get out of committee even?
I don't know about the committee, but it doesn't have any vote, you know, significant votes in the Senate, and it even stumbled in the House. But I wanted to add something here. When I was doing a piece on the minimum wage for Bloomberg View, I interviewed Mayor Ed Murray, and he had something very interesting to say. He said he hopes his committee goes out, gets the information, and comes back with a great recommendation. So I said, well, Mayor Murray, what if they come back with like $13? Huh. He says, no. And he said, it could be 15 or 16. And so it's like, you know, even if Shama Sawant is negotiating here, she's got him in a position where at some point it's got to go to 15 because he has committed that.
That's what I'm saying is so amazing. There is this slow boil, as Joni put it, or the high boil, you know, in terms of the debate right now. But we're going to get to 15, it seems like, because nobody is pushing against that. And I just want to say quickly, we've given Ed Murray a lot of grief for all the committees that he's created on all these issues. But actually here...
You're on one, I think, aren't you?
I'm on the committee to observe committees.
Yeah, very good.
You see the political wisdom in having these committees on display right now, because the boil goes on for a month and people hash it out and, you know, rhetorically bloody each other and figure out, well, what would work? And, you know, you see where the opposing sides can actually find some agreement or if they can't. And then after all that's done and everyone's exhausted, Ed Murray comes in and says, this is what I support. And it probably will be somewhere right in the middle. And if there's an unbridgeable gap at that point, he'll choose a side.
Do you think that this... Well, before I ask that, is there a way to help the small businesses who say, look, we're going to have to shut down, close jobs, if that argument's true? And I know there's lots of arguments economically on both sides, whether a minimum wage creates or hurts job growth. Is there a way for the city or the state, but we'll stick with the city for now, to have policies that would actually help people sustain the jobs in the small businesses as they move up the ladder? I mean, are there historical precedents? Is there a way to create policy?
Well, I'll just give you one example, but don't forget the state of Washington, the number increased slowly. But there was all this talk, if you go back to the 1998 Initiative 688, I think that's the right number. If you go back to that, they talked about how businesses in eastern Washington next to Idaho, which had the federal minimum wage, how they would sort of dry up and not be healthy. And frankly, that is not what happened. They didn't pick up and they didn't move to Idaho. And you look at job creation in Washington, it's quite strong. The unemployment rate in the whole state is, what, three clicks now below the federal one as of, I think, this week, 6.4 to 6.7%. So there, the same concerns were said when this happened. The only difference, though, instead of jumping like in a year to 15, as some people are suggesting, the state minimum wage went up slowly.
Yeah. So then that's the scenario. Whether the state or the city has any support for these businesses, that's the scenario you guys both see flowing out. The gradual increase.
The likely outcome, yes. A phase in. I mean, that's what I would guess right now, but we'll see. The other thing is, and this comes up repeatedly in these debates, experience has shown that when you raise the minimum wage, people have more money and they spend it. And so this ends up helping small businesses and all businesses.
That's the theory. The other theory.
It's not just a theory. It's the experience in Washington State, for example. And there's another thing that doesn't get discussed enough, and I know I've discussed it, you know, here, and I'll bring it up again.
Taxes?
Yes.
Oh,
the reason that there's...
Right.
Well,
no, go.
Roll your eyes, but it's true. The reason that there is so much pressure to increase the minimum wage is because we have a regressive tax system in this state that punishes the poor. If that didn't exist, if business owners of all stripes want the pressure to raise wages to decrease a little bit, then we should rejigger or fundamentally restructure, really, our state tax system so that it doesn't disproportionately punish poor people and leaves more money in their pockets to spend at businesses. So that would mean an income tax.
What happens when you have these islands of higher minimum wage, SeaTac in Seattle? I don't know if there are other cities that are going to be like that. If that has, you know, whether or not it actually generates real momentum, for example, for a statewide initiative, or if it just kind of messes with the economy in kind of an unpredictable way.
Well, the theory of the supporters of it, SeaTac, for example, when they did it, was that we see this as an island that shows the possibilities and then drives momentum out across the state.
Right.
Yes, but the SeaTac, the judge ruled that most of the employees there were not affected by it. But another example, first of all, airports, many West Coast airports have really high minimum wages. And also the city of San Francisco currently is ahead of Washington State's number of 932. They're 1074, as I said earlier. But I don't think they've had that for enough time to know sort of what it means. And San Francisco is so expensive. Yeah. But it is viewed as a similar city to Seattle. So expensive.
The other issue we should throw out there, aside from the phase-in, is the exemptions. Are there going to be exemptions for nonprofit organizations? Are there going to be exemptions for the food service industry? These are all things that are going to be debated as well, and that a lot of people are saying are necessary. Take the social services example. These are organizations that feed the homeless or provide counseling for people who are destitute and who don't have enough money to pay $15 an hour. And the result there is not simply it's not the same as when a business disappears, although that is sad and unfortunate for everyone involved. But when a social service agency disappears, there are huge ripples from that.
Yeah. But of course, the problem is somebody who's worked for a nonprofit. When nonprofits are stuck in this sort of second tier economic reality, then the people that work there, I think we could look at childcare workers, for example, right now, they never can get out. And part of a nonprofit's mission is to help the people that work for them as well as the people they serve.
And that's so true. And you imagine a city where working at McDonald's pays you more than feeding the homeless. And that's not the city we want to live in either.
We're taking care of the people working at McDonald's children.
Right.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back on this. Our number is 206-543-5869. Or you can write us weekinreview at kuow.org. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Peter Jackson. This is the Week in Review. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger, and Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. She also contributes to Bloomberg News. So we got this email just speaking about these issues, about the minimum wage and the debate that took place at Town Hall and how it affects people. This is from Michael. As a small business owner, I have no issues with gradual increase in the minimum wage, but was blown away by one of the comments KUW played earlier this week. When we went to the Town Hall meeting that took place. It was a protester commenting that it was impossible to live on Capitol Hill making minimum wage. The idea that a low-skilled worker should be entitled to live in one of the more expensive parts of the city really bothered me. When I made very little money and was fresh out of school, I ate ramen and lived in a crummy apartment in the rough part of Chicago. Is there in this debate about the minimum wage a sense that we're trying to stop, if only we could stop the gentrification of Seattle and the rich parts of Seattle?
There is a sliver of something there in the sense that Capitol Hill 10 years ago, you could live on easily making what people are shooting for, which is $15 an hour. And you could live there making even less probably. Now, you can't live on Capitol Hill making $15 an hour. It would be very difficult. So I get the sentiment and kind of the resentment, but there's something wrong with all the statements involved, because basically, even if you got to $15 an hour, a lot of the people who are seeing rent spike on Capitol Hill and the cost of food and so on go up in that area are going to be in the same boat.
You know this. Go ahead.
Can I go back to the exemptions for a second?
Please.
So a lot of folks think that's a good idea, and it may be. It may be for nonprofits, for very small businesses. But again, I'm going to quote Tom Douglas, who said absolutely no exemptions, because what happens is, so a lot of restaurants, let's say you said it was 25 employees or less. That's just an example. You don't have to pay. So then a guy like him, he has quite a few more employees than 25, would be at a huge disadvantage. And the price of chicken would go kind of crazy under that scenario at his place. And I don't know why he's picking on chicken, but he did.
Well, I mean, you know, we've all been looking at this. We're going to look at it, too. I mean, part of the issue here, of course, is there are people who argue that the $15 an hour minimum wage economic debate is the wrong debate to be having, because it really doesn't address underlying cause of the inequality that's growing in the country. You talked about taxes and the inequality of taxes. How we allow and build affordable housing is a big problem there. And hence, you know, people probably could live on ramen and noodles on Capitol Hill if they could find some affordable housing there. But it's hard to find affordable housing. So all this debate is very much wrapped up in the other things that people like Shama Swant writes. Here's one more email here. This is from Ruth. driving small businesses to close because of $15 minimum wage now seems to parallel the closure of small businesses following the opening of Walmart or other big box stores. Can this possibly be what Sawant wants? I think not. I'm sure not. We just end up in this very, very interesting economic debate here about what is the best move forward and what's an unintended consequence.
Another thing that hasn't been mentioned is all the sort of add-ons that we do. So you have library levies, park levies, metropolitan improvement districts. I mean, you know, this, you want to talk about, you know, things that people want, but then they add to the bill that makes living in Seattle more expensive. If everything is a la carte, you know.
The point about advantaging big businesses, big national conglomerates that can absorb the cost of paying, you know, higher labor and still keep their prices somewhat low is a good one and very, very important in this debate. But what exactly can the city council do about that? The problem is our state tax system. Mm. One good result of this debate and this step forward, which is not the only step to make, obviously, could be that small business owners and low-wage workers start to see that they are not each other's adversaries so much as they together have a mutual adversary, which is a system that benefits large corporations far more than them. You don't have to look at Walmart to see this. You could look at Boeing.
You know, what's interesting also about this debate, and I was wondering if Tom Douglas touched on this, is that there has been an argument, I've heard it mostly on the East Coast, that, and this is about restaurants and the food industry, that the idea of that we need to get rid of the idea of tips as a way to supplement people's salaries, and that instead those companies have to figure out a way to pay everybody equitably, even if it means raising their wages, because that way they can offer a decent wage, and in the end the consumers will pay more, but won't be, in a sense, asking those people to supplement their wages through tips and their health care through tips.
Well, apparently there's I didn't totally understand this, but apparently there's a cost to restaurants that Tom Douglas did mention, which is that he has to report the amount of tips based on the credit card receipts. Hmm. And somehow it's automatically 18%. And so that has another cost for him
A lot of food and beverage people like cash.
Yeah.
And so do restaurants. But it does, again, it's another way of shifting costs onto the low-wage worker. All right. Well, we'll move on from that. We'll move on from that onerous debate. And we'll come back to it because I have a question about a few things in the terms of the pot, which is supposed to be bringing so much money and offering us so much. I don't know. Did you guys get a chance to hear the ad the first legal ad that is run about marijuana?
No.
And that it basically says you wouldn't buy fish from this guy, so why are you buying pot? Let's have legal pot. And I mean, we are moving ever closer to what's happening there. I was wondering, at the same time, we have Jerry Brown. Here's what Jerry Brown said. He was on Meet the Press, and this is what Jerry Brown said about what was happening with what he thought about legalizing pot.
The problem with anything, a certain amount is okay, but there is a tendency to go to extremes. And all of a sudden, if there's advertising and legitimacy, how many people can get stoned and still have a great state or a great nation? World's pretty dangerous, very competitive. I think we need to stay alert, if not 24 hours a day, more than some of the potheads might be able to put together.
All right, well, there's that. And here's some of the advertising he's worried about. This is this 1 minute spot for a website that connects medical marijuana patients with doctors in states where medical pot is legal.
I got tuna, I got salmon, I got sweet shrimp, I got the finest sashimi this area has seen in years. You need me and I need you. Let's make this work. You buy some sashimi, I'll throw in some rice paper, man. Totally free, gratis. I got everything, even California rolls, baby.
You wouldn't buy your sushi from this guy, so why would you buy your marijuana from him?
All right, so those ads are running on Comcast between 10 p.m., 5 a.m. in the morning. Same hours. Same hours.
The right time.
Alcohol ads run then, too, yeah. As well. But we're going to be seeing a lot more of this, don't you think? We heard the United Nations not so happy with what Washington State and Colorado were doing in terms of trying to, you know, fight the war on drugs.
But this is an ad to get California to move toward the system that we've already arrived at.
This ad, well, of course, this ad is also just sort of promoting the idea of medical marijuana, because I think it's going out around the country, at least around the West Coast.
Yeah, but California already has medical marijuana, so yeah. I think that they...
You think
no,
they
Governor Moonbeam was trying to stop, a Washington or Colorado-type initiative in his own state, but he said...
I can't believe you're still calling him Governor Moonbeam.
I couldn't help when I heard his voice again. I hadn't heard it in a while. I was like, oh, Moonbeam.
It's sort of wonderful to hear him sound like the scolding uncle, or even to think that he's 76.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, he said he would watch the experiment here before he stakes out a position. But I think it's because he's been driving on those California highways, which I was down in California this week, and stoned and on your phone. This is not a good combination for the whole driving thing.
No.
A lot of them are on their phones. But, and I don't mean like on the phone like I'm talking. I mean the keyboard.
I don't know if we can blame marijuana on that or just dumb action of people behind the wheel.
They don't have the driver also of the revenue. I mean, now that there's actually a surplus in California, this notion of pot taxes is probably less compelling. And I don't know how much that informs the intensity of it.
Considering
you know,
the pot growers of California helped kill that first legal issue.
You know how they got to a budget surplus in California? A tax on the income of high earners.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. It reversed their huge budget deficit that had made California the laughing stock of the country for a long time and ended them with, I think, something close to $30 million in the bank.
But here we are, the United Nations, their drug watchdog agency. I mean, they're saying this is a threat to the international fight against drug abuse. I mean, are we about to start seeing sort of a cultural pushback against the legalization efforts here and in Colorado?
I think it depends on how the experiments roll out. So far, you mostly have, data from Colorado because they opened first, because they converted their medical marijuana shops basically overnight, although there was some delays, into the recreational shops. We took a different tack here. We're doing sale seed to sale, and so we're going about it differently. One thing to be careful here is it's all about the expectations. So during the campaign for pot legalization in Washington, there was this OFM report that came out and mentioned that there could be like something like 0 to 2 billion in a certain number of years in revenues. And everybody seized on the 2 billion, which was about a half billion a year in this prediction. It's nowhere near that. It's not going to be that much. But in Colorado, so that sale point of whether or not you should legalize so that you get all this new revenue. In Colorado, they sort of lowballed it, or didn't maybe intentionally do that, but they just came up with a low number there. And now pot sales are going to exceed that by maybe 25%. And so it does matter what you tell the voters you're going to come up with.
Although, as we've seen in our state legislature, any extra million is a big deal because the budget has been so tight and continues to be.
You know, by the way, just on that point, earlier this week we talked to Tacoma Mayor Marilyn Strickland. And she was one of several mayors around the state who signed a letter to Governor Jay Inslee because these mayors are saying they want a share of the $190 million in tax revenue the state is expecting to rake in. And this is something part of what she said.
The cities who have decided to comply with the will of the voters should collect revenue on marijuana sales, either at the manufacturing level or the retail level. But also understanding that we decided to do away with prohibition of marijuana, and this is new territory for everyone. So we have to think about how we can manage this at the local level.
Of course, managing at the local level means that some of those cities have said we're not going to allow marijuana within our confines, within our borders. They still want some of that money too.
Well, first of all, there isn't that much money to have. The $190 million is over 4 years. I saw Reuven Carlisle quoted, I think it was in a tweet, where he said this is a good policy discussion to have once the money starts flowing. But we haven't seen any yet.
He wants to wait till the money comes in.
He wants to wait till there's real money on the table. You know, I think it's $51 million in the next biennium, not this biennium, but the next one, or maybe at the end of this one. I think it's at the end of this one. But anyway, wait till we see what we get, and then we can start debating who gets a piece of it.
Hmm. Of course, Colorado's pot revenues have proven to be a little more... a little higher than they had originally projected, and that may be the same with us over time.
Over time. Depends on if we get some of those stores open. They're just putting out the licenses now. We're rolling out slower.
Is it really going to start in June?
If they get those licenses out and get some pot grown, which wouldn't hurt.
I think the pot's probably
It's already growing. It's already, I can hear it growing. I can hear it growing as we speak.
I think we're going to see some transfers. What did you make of U.S. Representative Dave Reichert? On Tuesday, he introduced a bill to ban the use of welfare benefit cards at stores selling marijuana. And he added them to a list that already contained prohibition of using those cards at casinos, liquor stores, strip clubs, and tattoo parlors. Is this just sort of a political stunt?
A little bit of a stunt, but at the same time, a little bit proactive. I mean, you can say that you've eliminated some of the silliness, but it clearly strikes a chord with the anti-marijuana folks as well, who already pigeonhole most pot smokers as welfare food stamp folk, not realizing that what is it, probably 5 or 6% who regularly smoke pot are probably middle class. Folks who live in Dave Reichert's district.
This article went around. I'm sure you guys all read it. I thought the interesting fact was Reichert was citing the National Review Online. Colorado welfare recipients had used their benefit cards 64 times in January to withdraw cash totaling $5,000 at places selling pot. That was out of a total of 42,000 electronic benefits transfers that month. So, I don't know, tempest in a teapot?
Not a big problem in Colorado, obviously. And I agree with Peter, it's, people shouldn't be using their welfare benefits to buy pot at state stores. I would agree with that. It's not a big problem in Colorado. And Reichert bringing this up plays maybe to the concern that Peter was bringing up. And I think also just to the general concern among some conservative voters that any welfare recipient is perpetually trying to game the system and do something they shouldn't be. And our elected representatives need to stand up to that. That's been a very successful line for Republicans for a long time.
You know why they have the ATMs in the pot stores, of course, because the banking rules had made it so difficult for pot store owners to use regular banking services.
All right, we'll take a break. Here's a couple of more emails that came in about the minimum wage. I just wanted to read to you all. This is from Mark. As stated by the owner of the City Peoples in the Seattle Times a couple weeks ago, an exemption for small businesses would not work because no one is going to work for $12 an hour at a small business when they can get $15 an hour at Fred Meyer or QFC or McDonald's. They won't be able to find employees, something that Eli had touched on. John writes, I'm more in favor of a minimum income. You'd be guaranteed a minimum income, and if your job doesn't hit this minimum, the government would cover the rest. Where this has been done in the U.S. and abroad is worked out, and people do work jobs free of the worry of losing their job or their income. And Daniel writes, the problem is not that nonprofits can't afford to pay $15 an hour. This is what we had talked about earlier. The problem is that we, society, think that people with education and skills, often at least a BA, should only be paid $26,000 a year. And finally, Banton wrote, in response to the comment you just read from the listener who lived in Chicago and ate ramen, this gets to the very heart of the problem culturally. Why do only the haves deserve to live in a nice part of town? Why do we insist that low-wage, untrained workers live in crappy, dangerous neighborhoods? Hence, this issue is really a much deeper issue than even the $15 an hour minimum wage. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We're talking gondolas. This is the Week in Review. This is the Week in Review. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. And Joni Balter is a news analyst. You know, I want to talk about gondolas, but I do want to just touch on a couple of things. And I'm going to cycle back to the drug war and marijuana for just a moment and just ask your thoughts. Ex-Seattle Police Department Chief Gil Kerlikowske goes to run the Office of Drug Policy in the administration. Now he's going to lead Customs and Border Protection. There have been people who said Gil Kerlikowske skipped out of the running the Seattle Police Department just ahead of some of the scandals that have erupted.
He got out just in time. No, he's clearly gone federal on us. You know, he definitely wants to work at the national level, and he's been awaiting his confirmation for some time. So,
I don't remember him being a big supporter of legalizing marijuana.
Absolutely the opposite.
Yeah,
absolutely the opposite. He really carried that on for some time. You know, it's not like he was like...
He was big on decriminalizing or lowering the penalties for it.
But it's not like he was like, he wasn't really active in our campaign or anything. He didn't work very hard on that. But he just made his views clear and then seemed kind of quiet about it after that.
Yeah. You know, September 1st, the restarting for Bertha, September 1st, it's got some bearing problems.
And September 1st, if you read the articles, is optimistic.
Optimistic. This is very optimistic.
Exactly.
They still have to get in there, dig the hole, pull it out. We don't even know which way they're going to go. I don't know what to think about it other than, you know, we're going to talk about the waterfront plan in a moment. And boy, you think about the waterfront plan.
How did all these parts, how are all these parts breached? All these bearings and wrappings around bearings. It's just kind of amazing. And it's so early in the project. That's what's sort of stunning. And just all these efforts, as you know, and we'll get to that later, but about the ledge trying to, you know, let's get ahead of it and figure out who's going to pay for this. Clearly, it's going to slow things down. And it's going to cost some extra money.
I think one of the more disturbing aspects of the coverage this week was that DOT, the Seattle Tunnel partners, the other people involved, didn't seem to either be communicating or maybe they were communicating through lawyers. They were trying to be very careful about just what you were saying, who's responsible. But do we really want lawyers in front of engineers on how we run these programs? It seems to slow things down a little too much.
Well, the state is making two promises at once. One, we're not going to be put on the hook for any problems that the contractors caused. Two, we're going to finish this on time. And so you're right. Those two things are at odds when it comes to communicating. And I don't know what the solution is there, because the state does need to get its lawyers involved to make sure that we don't get left with a bill that we shouldn't be left with.
And it has such great symbolic value for legislators who aren't from the Seattle area as, you know, examples of transportation boondoggle, that one more reason not to invest in transportation, or that it's too Seattle-centric.
Is that, you think that's been the, is that part of the message that Olympia's picking up?
Well, I thought the message in Olympia is don't ask me to vote for anything that has the T word in it.
Transportation.
Tax. Before an election, because I'm just not going to do it. So there, take that.
Because it's just too frightening for them to contemplate?
You know, right. And, you know, there's a lot of spending, and they like to go out to these, you know, swing suburban districts and say we held the line. Don't you think so, Peter?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's interesting how the Senate has, I don't say grandstanded, but certainly has tried to show that they're doing something, when in fact they know, in, you know, 2014, an election year, that there's just not going to be any movement.
Well, it's a little unnerving, though, because we're supposed to be on time and on budget, as you were saying, Eli. But also, you know, we want to get that viaduct down.
Right. The longer the viaduct stays up, the more likely it is to come down without our intervention.
As we talked about 2 weeks ago, it is settling again, and there all that tunneling underneath.
What was your number? Four and four tenths of an inch.
Yeah, settling, sinking, sagging. I just want to recall that image, that supposedly reassuring image from the guy at the Department of Transportation who said, "Well, yeah, but if it settles uniformly, it could just sink all the way to the ground, and there wouldn't be a problem.
We'd have the roadbed that people want."
Right. That's the surface transit option.
That's Bertha without Bertha.
Oh man! All right. I'm going to cycle back around to the waterfront in a minute, because I also – two other political things that happened. I was just curious about your reaction. Somebody finally got a chance to talk to former mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn. He's fixing his bike, joining a charity board.
Speaking of cycling back around.
Yeah, there you go. Nicely done.
So that was Emily Hefter from the Seattle Times.
He gets the award for segues.
And she was trying to just catch up with Mike McGinn because, you know, after like, what is it, 3-4 months, what are you doing? He did mention a mild interest in running again.
I thought that was interesting.
Mild interest, just wanting to build on the folks he met while he was in office, but he didn't identify anything, and he certainly didn't. Can you see Mike McGinn running for one of the district elections?
I think we've discussed that. I can see that.
And I think we've said he's in the 5th district, the new 5th council district, which doesn't have someone running for it right now.
Yeah. And he's joining the Social Justice Fund. That's the board he's joining. It's a, you know, and then the Environmental Justice Giving Project event. So he's sort of playing that up. So I don't know if we said Mike McGinn was dead when he lost to Ed Murray politically, but he's not.
No, it's not like he ran 3 times and lost or something. He ran once and won and then another time and lost. So he's... That doesn't stop you.
No.
I've never seen that stop anyone else.
And if the tunnel turns into a huge failure and a financial boondoggle, there's a route back into office for McGinn.
The I told you so route?
Yeah. It's happened before. I was trying to remember who. I'll look it up. But there's a well-known politician who ran a campaign like that, and the campaign slogan was "Because he was right."
Yeah. Well, that's nice. Well, I like the way McGinn ended that article that Emily Hefter wrote in the Seattle Times. There's no such thing as mayor's school. Hence,
but that actually isn't true. They sent Ed Murray to mayor's school at Harvard. So what did McGinn miss the fact that you can get a free trip to Boston and sit there with some other mayors?
I think it was even deeper than that. I read that as McGinn saying, you can go to Harvard.
Yeah, that's what I said.
That's not going to teach you what you need to know.
Yeah, I think so, too. And the other quick thing was sort of catching up on some other stories. Nick Licata sends out an urban politics newsletter. And one of the things he wrote in his newsletter this week was that police discipline, which is supposed to be going under the OPA and other disciplines, well, I'll just say it, that he says there's a real problem with the OPA because the fact that the police chief overturned some of these disciplinary reviews, the fact that it's wrapped up into negotiations with the Seattle Police Guild, the union, has left this system wanting. That has been the criticism. Now here's another city council member, one who's been involved in the reform movement of the SPD, saying, here's the hole, and I want to address that. As we see this unfolding, we see Ed Murray's going to have to deal with that.
Well, things sort of quieted down for Ed Murray this week on that front, but that is clearly what we have found out now, that there was such a ruckus, over the fact that these discipline charges had been changed, and what's the plan? I thought that a lot of people thought that we were fixing that we were going to be more reform minded, and so clearly that is, and Nick is speaking to that.
The person who ran on a re-elect me after some perceived failures campaign under the slogan "Because he was right," Dennis Kucinich.
Very nice.
Back in Cleveland.
No, very but he nice. Wanted to remember when he wanted to come here and be a member of Congress.
It may still happen. Joni Balter is news analyst at KOW, hosts of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. Luke Burbank is host of Live Wire and the Too Beautiful to Live podcast. Hey, Luke.
Hello there, everyone. I think I've figured out the issue with the tunnel, and it is, and we should have learned this from episodes of Scooby-Doo, from other important, sort of research projects. Never go underground. No good comes from going underground. It's where mole people live. Mm. It's probably some kind of Native American burial disturbance happening. We should have gone with a gondola, I'm telling you.
That's what I was going to say. There you go. Now, where are you right now?
I'm actually on First Hill. I am trying to navigate the...
He's trying to get on the gondola.
Yeah, I know. I'm just standing on the corner with a sign I made trying to get people excited about this gondola idea. So far, I'm having kind of a mixed response.
You could go from First Hill to downtown if that gondola was...
Every 20 seconds or something like that.
There's got to be a way to just rewire these trolley wires I'm looking at. They look stable enough. They're running right down First Hill. I mean, you could probably hang a gondola on that.
An electrified zip line is what that would be.
Luke, did you take a look at the waterfront plans that were released this week for the downtown waterfront in Seattle?
Yeah, I was particularly taken with that floating temporary pool,
I thought
that was great. Although, I feel like these architects, these sort of dreamers, these futurists who draw up those cool plans, I resent them in a way because they always draw these amazing things up that make me so excited, and then when we ultimately see what gets built, it's never nearly as cool as what they created in their minds. It's kind of let's keep the expectations where they should be.
Well, did you see Skip Berger, Knut Berger's piece this morning where he was talking about he didn't like the drawings because they showed such nice weather, and all the people looked like they were height, weight, proportional, or however you phrase that. And, he just wanted it to be more look more like Seattle. He wanted a drawing that was in the clouds with rain coming down.
Right.
Can I play you a cut of an interview I had with James Corner, and we talked about that very issue?
They do want it to feel authentic to Seattle. They do want it to be special, but they don't want it to be too ritzy or too New York or too London or too Los Angeles. They want it to be specific to Seattle. And I think we've worked very hard to try to understand the Seattle psyche. And I think the design really reflects all of the input that we've had.
Except I asked him as well, it's raining. Are we going to be able to have some places we can get in out of the rain when we're downtown with our psyche intact? And he said,
So where's the roof over the swimming pool?
If it's good enough for baseball,
I want to know where the roof is over the swimming pool.
Or why does the barge float away in the winter? That's when we need a warm pool to sit in on the waterfront.
Yeah, Luke, do you – I mean –
Is there going to be some kind of a drying rack to put your polar fleece bathing suit that you had to wear?
Exactly right. Somebody up in Everett, Peter Jackson, what do you think of this downtown waterfront plan?
Well, I kind of agree with Knut's piece that it kind of resembled a North Korean propagandist piece. And a place like Everett, we would be more kind of WPA style schematic, you know, like a Kenneth Callahan.
Painting, a good idea.
Yeah, with someone in overalls carrying lumber or something, and a little bit more realistic with rain. With rain, I think people in Everett will still venture down, at least once a year to check out the gondola and the waterfront. But
check out the gondola. Everybody's going for that gondola. You know, Luke, aren't you moving out of Seattle?
I am actually, and I'm moving up to Port Townsend. My wife and I. And so as part of that, I've been taking the ferries a lot lately because often I'll take the Bainbridge ferry.
You might want to get used to those.
What's that?
I said you might want to get used to those.
Yeah. Well, as I've been coming back from Bainbridge to Seattle, I'm really struck by how beautiful the downtown Seattle waterfront is and how little it seems, in my experience, to be used by people from Seattle. You know what I mean? Like, think about the last time you actually went down and checked out Ye Olde Curiosity Shop or the Red Robin that's down there. Like, so anything that I think kind of leverages and takes advantage of that area, because it's been years since I've been down there, and as I sit on the ferry, I'm thinking, why am I not down here more? This is an amazing intersection between an urban environment and, a body of water.
Well, next time we meet, let's meet down there, because I have been wandering the waterfront a lot, and I find it fascinating. Even now, while we still have the Seattle psyche down there, is there some place that you enjoy down at the waterfront, Eli?
The part of the waterfront that I enjoy actually makes the argument for the waterfront project that's envisioned. I really now like the Sculpture Park and getting there on my bike through Myrtle Edwards and the trails that have been restored through the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway Yard and what that has that the current waterfront doesn't have, or actually I reversed it, but anyway, that if you tore down the viaduct, basically there's a giant wall between the city and that part of the waterfront, and when you get north of the viaduct to the Sculpture Park, Myrtle Edwards, and so on, the waterfront integrates into the city, and there's not a psychic block, speaking of psyches, between the urban area and the waterfront area.
And hence the sort of competition that we've seen this week between gondola versus, what is it, glass elevator. Mm. We've got to find a way to get from high down to the actual water level.
All right, Luke, you got any last words?
Well, the other thing that's been exciting for me about being out on that water a lot is that I just remembered that Magnolia exists. I mean, seriously, how often in your given week do you even remember that Magnolia is part of Seattle? Like, it's right there if you're on the water, but man, I mean, Magnolia is an hour from Magnolia. It's really remote, but it looks beautiful from the ferry, I'll tell you.
All right, good. Luke Burbank is host of Livewire at 8 o'clock Friday nights. You should listen to that. Recorded down in Portland, broadcast around the region. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. Joni Balter is host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. And Jason Pagano reminds me that you know what's down on the waterfront that we often imbibe in? Clam nectar from Ivers. We'll go there next time. Jason Pagano produces this show. Bernard Bellette's our engineer. Thank you all. See you next week.